Spring has sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
This is a much more professional military. You know, the odds of something going wrong while we go in and do this, much higher. Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategy, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, I thought we were going to be sitting here sweltering, but it's about 30 degrees cooler than it was yesterday.
Yeah, it is pretty wild. We have a really interesting guest who'll be on in a little bit, but you and I have a number of things to talk about. Maybe I'll start off with my jackassery, but then I also want to try to cheer you up, if I may, which is probably a bootless quest, but I'm a friend, so I'll attempt it anyway. So the jackassery is Trump endorsing Ken Paxton in Texas at the expense of John Cornyn, long-term senator from Texas. And, you know, on the one hand, this is being interpreted as, you know, this shows Trump's iron grip on the Republican Party. Paxton's an enormously unpopular figure with a lot of his fellow Republicans. You know, does seem to be, he's a crook, his wife has denounced him as an adulterer.
His own staff turned him in.
And it's such an interesting act of self-harm, because it's conceivable that the Paxton might have won the primary without it. But, you know, this people seem to be saying that this is going to guarantee that he beats Cornyn, which, you know, it ticks off Cornyn, who now has nothing to lose by opposing Trump. It has clearly ticked off a lot of Republican senators. And the result is, I think you're going to see more oppositional behavior. You're already seeing some. And I think you're going to see more of it in a bit. The butterflies and unicorns part of my introductory remarks to show that, you know, there's some things that are going well. I want to throw a modest bouquet in the direction of my alma mater, Harvard University, where the faculty, after an enormous amount of wrestling, by a 2-1 margin, voted to set a quota of 20 A's plus 4 in any class at Harvard. Now, I should say a couple of things about this. When I was teaching, I would consider myself kind of soft if I gave 5% A's. The current percentage of A's at Harvard, I believe, is like over 65%. At Yale, it's even worse, like 80%. And it just shows you how standards collapse. There was an article by an economist at Harvard saying, yeah, well, in Ec 10, which I remember taking the introductory economics course, we only get 50% because we economists have standards. And it's just ludicrous. And it is something about the, you know, decline of the university. But I give them credit for doing that, although they have not set any limits on A minuses, which will now become the default grade. So in the spirit of that, I want to say two cheers minus for the Harvard faculty.
Ah, yes, the gentleman's A minus is what we'll now have to deal with. You know, I remember both when I taught at Zeiss, but also as a teaching assistant at Yale. You know, if you gave someone a B, or, you know, or God forbid a C, I mean, it was like you had made some damning judgment on their character. You know, and I kept trying to tell students, no, this is merely, you know, an evaluation of what you have achieved or accomplished in this course. It's not you know, a judgment on your soul. the people didn't believe that. Well, my jackassery of the week goes to the Trump administration for arguing that it does not need congressional approval for the Arch de Trump, which is now swollen to 250 feet tall. So it will be by about 150 feet taller than the Lincoln Memorial. It will be approaching the height of the Capitol dome. And the argument that it needs no congressional approval is because somebody dug up a 1925 report by the Arlington Bridge Memorial Commission of the day, which was apparently approved by Congress, had a plan for redoing the Memorial Bridge, which included four large columns, none of which were meant to be 250 feet like the Arch de Trump, nor were they shaped like the Arch de Trump. But because they've been approved somehow through some transitive property, of government, is retrospective approval for the Trump arch.
You know, this may be an interesting case to see if the Senate gets involved in this in some way and attest to the proposition that, you know, you now have a number of lame duck senators who don't have to worry about primaries or who have been royally screwed over by Trump, who will be willing to exact a bit of revenge. Another one, which I heard from somebody, which would be interesting, that there are a lot of people angry at Secretary of Defense, I repeat, Pete Hegseth, over the firing of U.S. Army General Randy George, saying that his preferred successor as Army Chief of Staff, General Leniev, will not be approved by the Senate. That there are a number of Republican senators are going to vote against him because everybody thought that Randy George was doing a great job, which apparently he was. And there'll be a bit of payback, which will be an interesting thing to see.
I'll be keeping my eye on that one for sure. Let's turn to whether the president's going to taco or nacho. We discussed that last week, but you know, since we were together last week, the president, called off an attack that he hadn't approved, but was going to happen, and has gone back to the negotiating table allegedly at the instance of our Gulf allies, all of whom unanimously came to him and said, "Please give diplomacy one more chance." Pakistanis have been actively engaged. I gather that there's, paper flying around out there between the Pakistanis and the Iranians, with the Egyptians and Turks getting involved. And Secretary of State and National Security Advisor Marco Rubio, a couple of hours ago, said he's cautiously optimistic. You know, there's progress being made. He doesn't want to get too optimistic, but he thinks it's not out of the question that you might get some kind of agreement. What do you make of all of this, both the meeting on Monday where this was discussed in-house and allegedly there were some perturbations inside the administration about this, but also the negotiation? How do you see all this, Elliot?
Well, so for the sake of both my reputation and my sanity, I've given up any attempt to predict what Donald Trump will do. I think you can say that on the one hand, he would rather not go back to large-scale military operations. But on the other hand, I do think the record thus far would suggest that he is very serious on the nuclear front and possibly serious on the Strait of Hormuz front. And so that's one kind of big fact, I think. And the other big fact is, I mean, the Iranians have staked out such extreme demands, you know, for reparations and all that, that I find it hard to see how they could compromise. Now, what I can imagine would be an agreement to have a discussion in 30 days, and, you know, that sort of thing. But I somehow think, you know, that would be a fragile agreement. And I guess I certainly find it almost inconceivable that you'd have a really durable accommodation with the Iranians. What you might get is a sort of an extension of what is a kind of a truce. But, you know, one important point I think people should bear in mind, you know, the war goes on. A blockade is an act of war. And they're blockading the strait, and we are blockading them. So people aren't getting killed, by and large, although they probably are in Iranian prisons. But the war is still on.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that strikes me is that we've seen the president, I think now 6 times since this war began, make, you know, really big threats on Truth Social, only to back off and either not execute them or, you know, say we need to give diplomacy more of a chance. But if diplomacy doesn't work, I'm going to hit them, you know, so hard I'm going to kill their whole family, kind of thing. And I think that that's had the effect. I could be wrong, but I think it's had the effect of conveying to the Iranians what you said earlier. He really doesn't want to go back to kinetic military activity. The longer this goes, every day that goes by, it's harder for him because public opinion is getting worse. His standing with the Congress, as you pointed out, is getting worse. We now, you know, Bill Cassidy, after he lost his primary, suddenly found his conscience and, you know, flipped on the question of a war powers vote. And I think it's had the effect of actually hardening the Iranian position. Because when you look at, you know, behind this dance of the seven veils that's going on with the mediators and the papers flying back and forth about what, you know, what one can tell from what's being reported in Israeli press, which seems to have pretty good sources, and some of the Arab press, is that the language is changing. You know, they're putting forth more a different language, and maybe there's some movement on the margins, but on the central questions, and I would say there are two. One is what happens with the HEU. The Iranian position hadn't changed very much. It's basically, we're happy to downblend the HEU, and we'll do it under some kind of supervision by the IAEA, which, of course, is a reversible step. And maybe we'll send some of it out to Russia, you know, but not all of it. And we're certainly not sending it to the United States. And maybe we'll agree to some moratorium on enrichment of some, you know, X number of years to be determined. That really hasn't changed much as far as I could tell. And maybe there's more going on behind the scenes than we know, but that seems to be their position. On the Strait, if anything, their position has gotten worse from, you know, from the point of view of the United States, our allies in the Gulf, and, international maritime rights. So if you look at the map they put out of, you know, what the Strait of Hormuz regional authority, you know, will look like, it's got, you know, authority over waters that go directly to the coast of UAE and Oman. And I can't imagine that'll be acceptable to our Gulf allies who reputedly were the ones who asked for this, you know, pause for diplomacy. Anyway, that's the way it seems to me.
Yeah. Look, I think part of what's going on here is it's a psychological phenomenon that, you know, human beings expect tomorrow to look kind of like today. And after you have, as you say, you know, a period of weeks where blood-curdling threats, nothing happens, you say, okay, that's the kind of world we're in. But what you do is you forget the shock that you felt when he actually launched a war that went on for 40 days with, you know, massive airstrikes and killing the supreme leader and all that. You kind of normalize that and say, okay, well, that was in the past, and the world we're in is the world of this sort of weird mutual blockade and blood-curdling threats that lead nowhere. And
no war, no peace. Yeah.
No war, no peace. And so I think there's a good chance that the Iranians, who I don't think are very sophisticated in dealing with him, could talk themselves into something much worse. The other thing which was I noticed, though, which I think is quite ominous for the future, and I think it's going to turn out to be serious, they are talking much more openly about assassinating Trump. So I think one of the key figures in the Majlis said they're going to put a 50 million euro bounty, basically, on Trump's head. and they're going to launch attempts to assassinate Trump and other certainly senior Israeli figures, but also senior American figures. And I kind of believe them. I mean, they have tried to kill Trump before. You know, they have done incredible and dastardly things. We did kill the Supreme Leader, after all, or it was probably an Israeli bomb, not an American bomb, but it doesn't make a difference. So I think that's, you know, that sort of thing, that may be further down the road, that may be post-presidency, but I suspect that we're probably paying a lot of attention to that. So, you know, all that to me adds up to what's going to remain a very unstable kind of position. Let me add one thing. I know there are other things you want to talk about. I was talking to a couple of former ambassadors who we both know from American ambassadors to that part of the world who know it very, very well and whose judgment I respect. And one of the things that they were saying was, you know, this, so many assumptions about the Middle East have been turned upside down, particularly since the October 7th attacks with, you know, the Israelis then taking out Hezbollah, that in turn enabling the fall of the Syrian regime, with everything that implies, and large-scale Turkish involvement. This war where, you know, you have the Iranians lashing out at their neighbors, which is not something we've seen before, not in this way. Open alignment between the Emiratis and the Israelis. Is that, you know, does that augur things to come, or does it just mean that both the Israelis and the Emiratis are in the Arabs' penalty box, and so on? And I think it's, you know, I'll stick by that metaphor that I think I used early on. A war, or a series of wars in this case, takes the chessboard, throws it up in the air, and the pieces come down, and they don't always come down in the same places that they were before.
Right. Undoubtedly true. And I, you know, just as I think neither we nor the Iranians themselves at this stage know, you know, what kind of what the condition of the regime is, because I think it's still too early. I think these sort of, you know, knock-on effects that you're talking about, we don't yet, you know, appreciate either. And it's, I mean, we can see some of the shimmerings. Can you say who the ambassadors were, or were you operating on Chatham House rules? It was Chatham House rules. It's a shame because I wanted to make a point, which is that it's good to have ambassadors, and we don't have them out in the region right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Reuters, I mean, is catching up to Shield of the Republic, because you and I have talked about this, I think, either last week or the week before, about the hollowing out of American diplomacy. There's a very long Reuters article about the fact that 109 out of 190-something U.S. diplomatic posts are vacant currently, that many of the people who understood and understand the extremely highly technical details of the nuclear file with Iran, who are career diplomats, have been pushed aside by Laura Loomer or others in the Trump administration. And so you have neophytes, you know, essentially trying to deal with extremely difficult technical subjects. So, you know, I'm glad you were able to talk to some ambassadors to shed some light on this in a restricted environment in Washington. It would be good if the administration actually had ambassadors it could talk to who actually knew something about the region and could actually help them navigate their way through some of these changes you're describing.
Couldn't agree more. These were, you know, tough-minded professionals, and NEA had a fair number of those. You know, you didn't always agree with them. I didn't, and I know you certainly did, but I always had a very, very high opinion of their expertise and commitment to the national interest. And you're absolutely right. And particularly in that part of the world where, I mean, in any part of the world, language, cultural sensitivity, you know, deep webs of personal connections matter an awful lot, probably nowhere more than the Middle East. And this is another tremendous act of self-harm.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the Middle East. The Reuters piece also talks about Bridget Brink.
It's all over the place.
Bridget Brink, who was our ambassador, a very capable ambassador to Ukraine, who's now running for Congress in Michigan. I wish her well in that primary. Her replacement, I mean, it just, you know, it goes on and on. You know, we've got no ambassador in Russia, et cetera, et cetera. So one other story that caught my eye the other night was the New York Times report that Israel and the United States had a regime change plan at the outset of this war that went awry. And the regime change plan was to find what we have speculated, you and I, from the beginning of this, which was that Donald Trump has started this looking for his Iranian Delcy Rodriguez. And apparently, who was the vice president in Venezuela, who he was able to turn to pretty effectively, you know, after Nicolas Maduro was extricated from Caracas. So the geniuses who cooked this up came up with former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was, you know, a Holocaust denier, who was the president falsely reelected in 2009, giving rise to the Green Revolution. Hardly a reformist of any kind, but that was who they were putting their money on. And he had fallen out with the regime, was somewhat at odds with the Supreme Leader and others, and was under a form of house arrest. And apparently the whole thing went a bit awry when in the act of trying to create a jailbreak that would get him out of house arrest, they not only bombed and killed his IRGC guards, but wounded him pretty seriously, which apparently soured him on the whole enterprise. Just one final comment. I want to be a little careful of what I say, but I remember reading that a minister of economy in Iran was quoted as saying that trying to brief President Ahmadinejad on the Iranian economy was like trying to teach particle physics to a donkey. And I just, you know, the idea that this was who the geniuses alighted on as a regime change, you know, candidate, just it boggles the mind.
So I take the point. This seems to have been an Israeli idea, at least that's the way it's reported. I think the it does seem to be a case of, you know, the covert action guys going overboard. Although, to paraphrase your old boss Don Rumsfeld, in a situation like this, you know, you go with the crazed, not very bright, demagogic,
Holocaust denier,
Holocaust denying criminal that you have, not the one that you want. But I think that the serious point at the heart of this is you're not going to have a Wilsonian Democrat take over in Iran. If there is some sort of break within the regime, it will come from somebody like this. That is somebody who has the street cred in terms of, you know, being revolutionary, IRGC, whatever. Somebody who has to be something of a thug, because otherwise you're not going to survive in that system, but who's really gotten disenchanted with the regime for any of a number of reasons, most of which are probably entirely personal.
It would help if they're thoroughly corrupt.
Right. And, you know, people have suggested that Ghalibaf may be like this.
Yes.
But I think, and here's, I think, the key point, which you and I would agree, that may very well be how it ends, but unfortunately it's going to have to be an organic process. And the idea that you can engineer it from the outside is, you know, I would take a lot of convincing. I mean, a lot, in order to believe that that sort of thing is really possible.
Yeah. I mean, I really think that this quote plan unquote, you know, qualifies for being pretty much utterly preposterous. Well, let's move on to the next, you know, regime change target, which is Cuba. So a federal grand jury has now indicted Raul Castro for his role as defense minister in the shoot down of the Brothers to the Rescue aircraft that were shot down in Cuba in the late 90s during the Clinton administration. It should be noted, I think there were some earlier indictments of the Cuban pilots who did the shooting, as well as the commander who ordered it. A lot of people are seeing this as a warning shot to the Cubans that, you know, we could presumably execute the same kind of playbook that we did in Venezuela, that would, that is say we could use an indictment to send in special forces and spirit, you know, Raul Castro out of the country. There's also a carrier strike group now entering the Caribbean. So very reminiscent of the buildup outside of Venezuela in the fall and winter, late last year, early this year. How do you see this playing out? And I mean, let me just be upfront with my fear. You know, look, the Castro regime is well by, you know, well past its sell-by date. It's a terrible regime. You know, there used to be a kind of romantic, I'm old enough to remember when there was a kind of romantic notion about the Cuban Revolution, you know, Vincent Ramos brigades. Yeah, people going to Cuba and talking about how great it was because they'd eradicated, you know, illiteracy, which is true. That, you know, that they'd brought, you know, healthcare to villages that never had it, which was also true. But it was done, of course, you know, at the cost of ultimately destroying the economy, including the agronomy that supports cultivation of tobacco and the manufacture of Cuban cigars. That's a subject for another day. But also, of course, the deprivation of human rights to Cuban citizens writ large, the number of people executed at the beginning of the revolution and jailed, you know, for years afterwards, the crushing of any dissent. So I will not shed a single tear when that regime, you know, goes away. Having said that, my fear here is that the playbook is going to be, let's find a willing, you know, sort of, you know, factotum who we can use to, and kind of Marco Rubio kind of advertised this in the speech he made, who will help us denationalize the economy, you know, get the kind of militarized Communist Party elite that controls the economy to denationalize, get out of business or go into business with people we select, you know, through crony capitalism, so that we can return Cuba to the wonderful situation it was in the 1950s, which brilliantly depicted in The Godfather.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Spring is sprung, and big savings are in full bloom at Menards. Visit Menards Garden Center for everything you need to get your garden growing. Choose from hundreds of beautiful, colorful flowers, lush trees and shrubs, and everything in between. Menards Garden Center is back in bloom. Stop in today to get your garden on. Check out fresh deals happening now at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is clearly an act of psychological warfare. What we don't know is whether Trump, after the awkwardnesses in Iran, is rethinking whether the Venezuela blueprint will work here. He may not. I mean, he may not be clever enough to do that. One big difference, of course, is also, I do think Rubio would be very focused on this, and I think his judgment is probably better than that of most of the people in the administration, but that's not saying very much. So I think, you know, you do have all those things. One of the things that worries me is it does seem to me Cuba's probably a much tougher nut, even under current circumstances, than Venezuela. You know, they had a capable military. For sure, their intelligence services. Look, I mean, was it in the 1980s? It turned out they were running all of our agent networks. They've had a lot of success penetrating DIA.
The Foreign Service, one of my colleagues, Manuel Rocha.
SAIS. I mean,
yeah, no kidding.
So I think that would be the bigger mistake that could be looming here. I mean, you just get a sense that the Venezuelan regime was kind of weaker and more more corrupt, less institutionalized. With a, you know, the Venezuelan military is not very much. I've never heard of anything about the Venezuelan intelligence services being particularly competent, other than it's just kind of bludgeoning people in the streets. And you know, Cuba does have this very strong history of nationalism, including antipathy to us and Jose Martin and all that. So, yeah. But again, once again, with Trump, you just don't know. You don't know if he thinks this is all a head game and pressure, or he'll have a plan presented to him. I mean, it does, that part, by the way, does bring us back to the discussion that we've had previously about, you know, what do you do if you're a professional soldier, if you're, say, General Kane, briefing him, because, you know, if, let's say Trump says, okay, I'd like a plan to do the same thing that we did in Venezuela. You know, the correct thing for Kane to do is say, okay, this is what it would take to snatch Raul Castro, and, you know, here's what we think the casualties would be like, and so on and so forth. Is he likely to say, but Mr. President, what could follow on after that could be something much, much more difficult? You know, that would very quickly take you into political areas, and would you'd depend on somebody like Rubio, who I think would have the best political judgment on this, to say, whoa, 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 Mr. President, you know, there are a lot of complications here that we didn't have in Venezuela.
I mean, in the first instance, I would hope that General Kane would say, you know, Mr. President, we got really lucky in Caracas. We had a helicopter that took fire and almost went down with you know, a bunch of our guys. And that, you know, would have, you know, the whole thing might have collapsed had it done that. This is a much more professional military. You know, the odds of something going wrong while we go in and do this, much higher. You know, and so you need to understand this is a higher risk, you know, mission than the one we did in Caracas, at a minimum, I would hope he would say. I think the potential complications here are enormous, you know, especially while we've got all this other stuff going on in the world. I have a very bad feeling about where it might end up going. So, well, this is one we're going to have to keep an eye on, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have such generalized bad feelings that I no longer detect the fluctuations all that much.
Yeah, I know. I hear you. So while we're, you know, talking about authoritarian governments, I'm just constrained to mention that, a terrible court ruling came down in Turkey, which has invalidated the Congress of the People's Republican Party, and Özgür Özel, the head of that party, has now been kind of stripped of his party leadership. And the question is, who becomes the party leader? It's pretty clear that Tayyip Erdogan would like Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who he defeated in the presidential election, who was tossed out as the head of the opposition party because of his fecklessness as a opponent of Erdogan's, to return to that job. Nothing could suit Erdogan better. But I don't know that there's a whole lot to talk about here, other than the fact that, you know, this is just another sign of Turkey's sliding into authoritarianism, and you know, kind of one party, one person rule. And it was accompanied by the president, you know, this week saying what a great guy Tayyip Erdogan is, and what a terrific ally he's been, you know, despite all of the problems we've had with Turkey along the way. And that's been echoed by, you know, Tom Barrack, the ambassador to Turkey and special envoy for Syria, in a way that I think has been unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, and it raises again the question, in a number of cases, alas, including in the United States, what is it going to be like when these aging autocrats really come to the end of the road? Because at the end of the day, they are mortal. You know, with Trump, I think it's easier to foresee, because I have enough faith in our institutions that I think he will not be president after 2.5 years. But in a case like Turkey, you know, how will he leave power? And as these people become more and more sensible of their own mortality, what are the risks that they're willing to take? What are the big things they want to do? Which is probably a pretty natural segue to our guest, who can talk about this, among other things.
Yeah. So before we turn to Mark Bennett's author of a book, a searing book about Russia's descent into madness, as he puts it, and authoritarianism under Putin. Let's just briefly talk about Putin's visit to Moscow.
To Beijing.
I'm sorry, to Beijing. Thank you. I mean, because it's an interesting contrast to Trump. Trump was just there, obviously. This was, you know, the partnership without boundaries, Putin and Xi. But you really got the sense that Putin really is the vassal here.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of discussion about the power of Siberia 2 pipeline, which they've been talking about for a decade.
Which they didn't get.
Which they haven't resolved, you know, either the volume of gas that China will take or the price. Chinese are driving, obviously, a very hard bargain, knowing that Putin is the demandeur and in a very weak position. Notwithstanding the fact that the president said that Xi really wants to do a deal on nuclear arms, couldn't tell that from the joint statement that was issued, you know, U.S. Golden Dome is destabilizing. Everything the U.S. is doing is terrible that the U.S. let the New START treaty lapse. You know, it's the cornerstone of strategic stability. Praise for Russia for continuing to honor the limits of the New START treaty, which if we continue to honor will make it harder for us to deter both Russia and China as China becomes a nuclear peer. So, you know, it's a kind of interesting contrast, I thought, to the Trump visit.
Yeah. It reinforces, I think, the view that on the one hand, the Chinese are not going to let Russia lose if they can help it. They would probably, I don't think they can really affect it, but they don't want Putin to go down. I'm pretty sure of that. And they don't want chaos. But you do have a feeling that they very much view them as inferiors. Now, they actually view them as cultural inferiors as well, but as vassals. And the Chinese are not always great at, or they in fact usually don't choose to disguise contempt and disdain for lesser powers. I mean, they have a very hierarchical view of the world. So I think one thing you can expect out of all this is the kind of treatment that Putin got will be more overt in showing what the real relationship is, and that will not go down well, possibly with Putin, but certainly among the, you know, the Russian leadership elite, who cannot be happy to see this.
Well, with that, let's turn to our guest, Mark Bennett, who's a former Times of London correspondent in Moscow, and the author of a recent book, The Descent: Witnessing Russia's Spiral into Madness Under Putin, which I heartily commend to our viewers and listeners as someone who lived in Moscow for 2 years during the late Soviet Union. I found this a searing and almost compulsive read. So, Mark, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
Thanks for having me.
Let me start by kind of asking you to explain a little bit how you came to be the London Times correspondent in Moscow. I would say your route into journalism was not, I would say, the kind of standard route. And I dare say that because your background was maybe a little atypical for journalists, it allowed you to have a kind of view of Russian society that maybe not all of your peers in the Fourth Estate in Moscow might have gotten. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't like to comment on my colleagues' expertise or whatever, but for myself, I was a university dropout in London, and I'd always been very interested in the Soviet Union and Russia. I mean, my earliest memories of kind of international affairs are of seeing Soviet tanks rolling into Afghanistan in 1979, Christmas. And then as I got older, it was just this kind of just this unknown entity on the other side of the world. I mean, I was always interested in America, but in culture, in books, but I never really wanted to go there. I was never very interested in traveling around America because I always felt like I'd seen it on TV. But all I'd ever seen of Russia on television basically was Red Square. Yeah? And so I was just kind of drawn to this unknown. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed and I began to read and see a lot more about Russia, and eventually I decided to go there in 1997 to teach English. I mean, I think it would be fair to say I didn't go there to teach English. It would be fair to say I taught English to go to Russia. It was just a way to get there. Eventually I got married to a Russian woman. Our child was born. Our daughter was born in Moscow. And I began doing freelance journalism, wrote a couple of books, and then became the full-time correspondent for The Times.
You know, one thing that struck me about your account of how you go into the world of journalism is it seems to me that you were particularly willing to get out of Moscow and go to some of the odder and tougher, sometimes more dangerous corners of Russia, which is, I think, where a lot of the vividness of the book comes from. And, you know, frequently the picture, as you say, is the one that we get from Red Square. Looking back on that part of it, including the somewhat scary bits, you know, where you're dealing with drunken people who want to cut you up for being a Westerner, what were the things that surprised you most when you encountered that side of Russia?
You're correct when you say that when you imply that kind of Moscow isn't Russia. I mean, the Russians say this themselves, but for many Russians, I mean, especially kind of middle class Russians, they're more likely to have been to, say, Barcelona than they are to kind of remote Siberia. And so for Russians, many Russians, their own country is kind of a mystery to themselves for people who live in Moscow. And I mean, traveling around Russia, again, it's quite hard to generalize because it's such a vast place. I mean, I have, for example, Yakutia, which is 7 hours flight from Moscow, and you get off and there's the Yakut people who they're not ethnic Russians. They have their own language. They have their own culture. A lot of it's based on kind of belief in shamanism. Then you have the far north of Russia with the Arctic coastline. Then you have kind of villages just in central Russia. But the thing that struck me most, I think, is this kind of great sense of apathy that that nothing depends on us, that everything is decided in Moscow. And in the book I write about one case where I visited a village where environmentalists were measuring uranium, which had been leaking into the village's only well. So it was poisoning the drinking water. And this old woman just rushed up to them and she was like, "Leave us alone, leave us in peace." And so I asked her, don't you care that your grandchildren might be drinking water that's been poisoned with uranium? And she was like, "What's it got to do with me? I can't decide anything. It's all decided there in Moscow. Just leave us alone." Which, I don't know, but I mean, you get the same attitudes in Moscow as well, to an extent. I remember once driving in a taxi, and this was during one of the periods when Putin was driving back and forth to the Kremlin in his vast motorcades, which would hold up traffic for like an hour. So everyone has to stop. All the traffic has to stop. And I was kind of grumbling, like, why do we have to wait? And the taxi driver said, but he is one and we are many. Of course we have to wait, which I thought was kind of the exact reverse of what most people in the West would say. Not that he is one and we are many. It was like, there's lots of us, there's just one of him. But he seemed to think that was perfectly normal.
Yeah, I think in Washington, whenever you see a presidential motorcade go by, you get very irritated because it, you know, stops traffic for a good 5 or 10 minutes. But could I just follow up on that?
I mean, people did get irritated, but I mean, and it was longer in Moscow. It was like an hour, 45 minutes, because they were just
so long
before he came. 15 minutes. Yeah, I mean, you could wait for 50 minutes.
Yeah, in the U.S., about 50% of the people along the route are giving the current motorcade the finger, and I don't.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
Probably don't do that in Russia.
Probably not doing that in Russia.
Quite dangerous to do that in Russia, yeah.
If I could just follow up on that, you know, on the one hand, you clearly love the language. You know, you married a Russian woman. You've got a daughter who I assume is a dual citizen. But I have to say, the portrayal of Russia you come away with just makes me even more pessimistic about the country's future than I was before. And I have some friends who have a deep attachment to the language and culture. My own grandparents spoke Russian, and you know, when I've gone there, the music's been familiar, some of the food has been familiar. There's some cultural twitches that seem familiar. But there are others who just say, you know, this, it's always been this way, it always will be this way, and really have this sort of essentialist view of Russia. How do you come out on that? Because it's, I mean, it's a fantastic read, but it is at the end a pretty dark one.
I mean, I'd like there to be some hope for Russia, but I think that Putin has reshaped Russia entirely in his own image now, and Putin's psychological problems, Putin's complexes, Putin's sadism, I think, has poisoned the Russian mind. That's not entirely to absolve the Russian people of any guilt for this, but I mean, I don't believe in collective responsibility. I mean, as Americans, do you feel yourself, do you think you were to blame, for example, for the Tomahawk missile that crashed into an Iranian girls' school? I don't consider you guilty of that, so why should I consider all the Russians guilty for the actions of a government that they didn't, that we don't even know how many of them actually voted for? Yeah, I mean, at least you have elections. In Russia, we don't know how many Russians supported Putin. But that said, it would be we would be wrong to deny that Putin has had significant support, that there has been significant support for the war in Ukraine, even though there have been many brave people who have stood up against it. But I think that if there was some hope for Russia, maybe 15 years ago, I think that since 2022, when the war began, that's going to take a very long time for Russia to return to anything kind of resembling normality, because the war has just, it's just destroyed any kind of sense of nation.
Yeah, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the mechanisms that you kind of talk about a bit in the book that, you know, brought Russia to this pass. I mean, when you start the book, you point out that, you know, Putin's rule was essentially rooted in the run-up in oil prices, and which gave him the ability to give the country a bit of stability after the turmoil of the, you know, 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And, you know, it's, you have a very interesting, about, I was maybe three quarters of the way through the book, interview with the late, Gleb Pavlovsky, who was a political technologist, one of the, you know, masterminds actually of Putin's rise, but who then fell out with him. Explain a little bit about how kind of all of this, you know, seemed to have developed over time, because it was obviously a lot of this was in place before 2022. I mean, you know, the war obviously intensified a lot of what you describe, but much of it was underway certainly from the time Putin returned to office in 2012. And some of it seems to have been built on what you describe as a semi-suppressed desire for revenge that it was already kind of coursing through Russian society a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a few things to tackle there. I mean, Pavlovsky was instrumental, as he admitted freely, in establishing Putin as a kind of all-powerful leader. He taught me that when Putin came to power, he thought that Russians needed a strong leader, kind of authoritarian state, that would kind of rid them of the need to make decisions for themselves. So he wanted Putin to decide, to have the image that Putin decides everything. And that's essentially how they set up the country. So that he said, if you had a problem, you had to come to us. If it was a business problem, political problem, any problem, Putin would decide everything. And his reasoning was that Russians needed some time to recover from the traumas of the 1990s, from the poverty, from the deprivations that gripped the country after the breakup of the Soviet Union. And that obviously was a great advantage to Putin, because he was essentially turning the country back into kind of Soviet Union light by this stage, closing down independent television stations, rolling back democratic reforms that had taken place under Perestroika, and afterwards, obviously. But when I spoke to Russians about this, about what Putin was doing, they were like, "Ah, we remember what democracy was like in the 1990s. This is the kind of leader we need." And democracy by the late 1990s was being commonly referred to in Russia as shitocracy. It's kind of a play on words, but they had no time for democracy, and they thought that what they needed was this kind of like strong hand, strong fist. I mean, I think the collapse of the Soviet Union and the loss of Russia's superpower status was traumatic for many older Russians, and it was something I think they never really got to grips with. And Putin realized this, and he played on this, and he used it to his advantage. And eventually, I noticed over the years that it was seemed to be even younger and younger people who were missing the kind of power that the Soviet Union once had, even though they hadn't themselves experienced the Soviet Union. So there was this kind of nostalgia for something they never experienced themselves. I remember one person told me that he remembered the Soviet Union a little bit. And this was in, for example, I think 2020, and asked him how old he was. And he was like 24. You can't remember the Soviet Union. So I don't know. There was this kind of weird thing going on where people had these kind of memories of the Soviet Union. It didn't even exist because Putin had to kind of spent so long creating this image of the past, and of using Stalin, for example, as a symbol of Soviet might. And yeah, coming back to the idea that there was this kind of suppressed desire for revenge, or that the Russia should be feared. I remember coming home from England one year in 2018, actually, after Sergei Skripal, the former Russian spy, and his daughter had been poisoned in the British town of Salisbury by Russian agents. And one of my neighbors asked me, "So how did I feel about Putin in England? Are they afraid of him?" And you could just see that she wanted me to say, "Yeah, they're terrified of him. They're really, really scared of Putin." And I was like, "Not really. Everyone just feels sorry for you that you've had this kind of this dictator in power for such a long time." But then I was thinking, like, why does she feel this need for me to feel, for British people to feel afraid of Putin? I mean, I would never have dreamt of asking her if, like, Russians felt afraid of Theresa May, for example, who was the Prime Minister of Britain at the time. So that was definitely there, I think. I mean, I was afraid of Theresa May, but that was a completely different issue.
there's a very poignant episode in the book where you talk about conversations with your mother-in-law. And I was wondering if you could share that with our listeners, because what it describes is not just a sort of a constant attitude of the sort you describe, but really a change in attitude, which, as I remember, coincides with the beginning of the Ukraine war, and you know, to the extent you feel comfortable, since you do share it in the book, if you would talk a little bit about that, and you know, what it tells you about where Russian society is.
Yeah, I mean, when I first met my future mother-in-law in the early 2000s, she would say things to me and my wife like, "Why are you in Russia still? Why didn't you just move to England? Nothing good is ever going to happen in Russia." And she would try to persuade us to leave and set up home in England, which we didn't want to do because it was interesting. We were, for various reasons, we were living in Russia. But as tensions with the West began to grow, after the annexation of Crimea by Ukraine, Russian state television just ramped up propaganda to terrifying levels, so that they would, for hours and hours and hours every day on television, on radio, they would just have presenters ranting about the West, just lying about Western countries. For example, that's illegal to call your parents mother and father. You have to call them parent number one and parent number two. In Denmark, there are special brothels for people who want to have sex with animals. Just like ridiculous, ridiculous things. And it was just countless. Just nuclear threats. And one state television presenter boasted, I think it was 2014 or 2015, that Russia is the only country in the world that can reduce the United States to radioactive ash. And it was just relentless. And I mean, I realize that now in America, you also have kind of extreme television stations, but the difference is in that Russia, there wasn't really much of an alternative. There was still some kind of opposition media around, but national television was just dominated. I mean, turned on television, this is what you were going to get, basically. You just had like choices between totally extreme, very extreme, or extreme. Yes. Pro kind of Kremlin views, and it just poisoned people's minds. And as the only kind of Westerner that my mother-in-law knew, and I just kind of grew in her mind into this kind of like demonic figure from the West who symbolized all the sins, as she saw it, of the West. And it just got worse and worse and worse until I couldn't even have a conversation with her. I mean, after 5 minutes, she would start talking about Ukrainian so-called Nazis, like kind of Western perverts. And so eventually we kind of mutually decided that it'd be best to stop speaking. And I haven't spoken to her for a number of years, which is quite sad. I mean, she's a good person, but her mind was just warped by Russian propaganda. I mean, she was an elderly woman, not in the best of health, living in the Russian provinces on not particularly large pension. And the television was just screaming at her all day long.
You know, one of the things that's, you know, I find very striking, and I note that, you know, the book has a blurb from Peter Pomerantsev, who we've had on the show earlier and who's written about Russian television. I mean, when I served at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow in the late 1980s, no Soviet citizen believed anything that was on Soviet television. You know, they were constantly trying to tune in to, you know, to Voice of America or BBC if they could get it, to try and get real news. Yet somehow, you know, Putin managed to create a media environment that's had this dramatic effect that you describe. And it's not just your mother-in-law. It's obviously a very large number of people who've been subject to that. And what has made that effective in your mind with Russians as opposed to the old Soviet agitprop, which, you know, clearly failed?
Well, I think that modern Russian propaganda differs from kind of Soviet propaganda in that it doesn't just have a single message. Yeah? I mean, the single message of the Soviet Union was that communism is the future, that the West is degenerate, whereas Russian state media just approaches from every single angle and often contradicts itself as well. But it's also it's not as dry as Soviet propaganda was. Soviet propaganda was kind of quite difficult to even watch or listen to, and as is Russian state media. But Russian state media is quite difficult to watch because it's so revolting and disgusting, but it's also kind of hypnotic as well. I mean, you can watch it and it draws you in. It kind of pulls you into itself, and it's a very appealing. I mean, I think it makes people kind of who maybe if you're poor, living in the provinces, you feel you don't have any power, you turn on the television and they're screaming about Russia's might, about how we're going to take Crimea, how we're going to do this, how we can defeat the West. So there's a kind of magnetism to it, I think, that Soviet propaganda lacked. And also Putin didn't ban Western media. And there was also kind of some opposition media was allowed until 2022, when we had this kind of overnight switch to neo-totalitarianism. Everything was banned until the start of the war in Ukraine. But Russian state television also spent a very long time before 2022 convincing Russians that that Western propaganda, Western media was also kind of a form of propaganda. It almost didn't deny that they were themselves pumping out propaganda, but they made it this kind of like this two-side thing. So, I remember one year, I interviewed this American mixed martial arts wrestler called Jeff Monson, who'd, despite not knowing any Russian, had been made a member of Putin's party and made a counselor in a town near Moscow. And I interviewed him, and he was quite open. He was talking about how he thinks Putin is kind of Putin's wealth is from illicit sources. So I read all this up, and then Russian state television ran an item about it where they accused me of manipulating this guy, Jeff Monson, and that I'd been given instructions by my editors in the West to make him say something bad about Putin. And I mean, I watched it. The bulletin was about like 10 minutes long, and they had experts who were talking about how Bennett's had been told by his editors to do this and do this and this. And almost by the end of it, I was always believing it myself. You know, it's kind of just so relentless. So yeah, I don't know. I think it's just a lot cleverer than Soviet propaganda, and just a lot more appealing to people who may feel as if they need some kind of outlet or some way to vent their fury, which I don't think communist propaganda really gave you that.
So, you have not, you left, I think, fairly shortly after the invasion of Ukraine, the full-scale invasion. But I guess one question I would have would be, you know, do you think the realities of that war are cracking through that propaganda? You know, given the war's gone on for a long time, it wasn't supposed to go on for a long time. You know, the casualties obviously very, very heavy, although not as felt as much in Moscow and Petersburg as elsewhere, including Yakutia. You know, Ukrainian strikes on very large and noteworthy targets, you know, particularly oil refineries, which give off a lot of black smoke when they go up in flames. Do you think the realities of this war break through that, or is the propaganda so powerful that most people continue to soldier on? I mean, you know, I've seen some polls, and I have no idea how you judge any kind of poll that's done in Russia, which suggests that Putin's popularity has declined and people are ready for the war to end. But it seems to me you probably have a much better informed view of that than I would.
I think, yeah, the war is coming home to ordinary Russians, including in Moscow. We recently had what were probably the most serious attacks by a foreign army on Moscow since the Second World War, when Ukrainian drones hit Moscow and the commuter towns around Moscow. So this is something that people can't notice, yeah? And also, as you say, it wasn't supposed to last more than 4 years. So I think there's people are becoming very weary of the war. It's likely, although we don't know, there have been kind of reports that members of the elite might be plotting against Putin, for example, but we don't have any kind of firm evidence of this. And it would be my view that I can't see how anyone in the elite right now would be brave enough to move openly against Putin, or would feel that they have the support to move against Putin. Even if there is kind of discontent growing among the Russian population, there's no real outlet for it. The Kremlin did a very clever thing, cynical thing, at the beginning of the war, which was it made it illegal to report kind of fake news about the war in Ukraine, to discredit the Russian army. And these were new laws, and they were punishable by 7-15 years in prison. So immediately you had hundreds of thousands of people flee the country. And these were the people who would lead any protests if they were to take place now in Russia. So kind of the bravest, most democratic people, they're now outside the country. And I think that the war is not going to end until Putin wants it to end. And I don't think that he will end it unless he gets what he wants, which is to kind of drag Ukraine back into Russia's sphere of influence as he sees it, because he's obsessed with it. I mean, the invasion of Ukraine itself wasn't rational, especially the amount of troops he had pour across the border. It clearly wasn't enough to conquer Ukraine, to take Kiev. He is obsessed with Ukraine. I mean, there was a document published recently where he was shown, even in the 1990s, to have been discussing with German diplomats about how Ukraine was not a real country, and he was just a minor official. Yeah? And he was talking about Ukraine is part of Russia, Ukraine belongs to us, kind of thing. So it's something that's possessed him, obsessed him for his entire adult life, and I think that he sees it as his life's mission. And he doesn't care how many Russians die. He doesn't care what happens to the economy. For him, this kind of idea of Russian might, this idea of restoring the Russian Empire, not the Soviet Union, but the Russian Empire, I think is overrides everything else for him. And I think he cares how many Russians die. And I think he cares how many people come home with no limbs, how many families are destroyed, and how many people are impoverished.
Yeah. I mean, you sort of end the book. You end the book really on a pretty downbeat note, I would say. I mean, you talk about interviewing various people, and you say they have some hope that Russia will improve, and you hope so too. But you basically, I think, leave the reader with a pretty gloomy sense of where Russia, is headed. I mean, given what you just said about the lack of a mechanism for deposing Putin, and the absence of sort of the kind of civic leadership that might create a opposition movement, what do you see as the prognosis in the next few years? Is it, are we just sort of got more of the same, that this war will just grind on, with more people dying on both sides, but no end in sight? Or do you see, the potential for some kind of disruptive change coming, one way or the other?
I can't see the war ending in the next few years, next 2-3 years. I can't see how it can end. I mean, Russia can't win. And Ukraine can't. How can Ukraine win? What does a Ukrainian victory even look like? Recovering all its occupied territory. I haven't met a single Ukrainian in the last year or two who thinks it's possible to recapture or to take back Crimea, for example. Donbass, Russia is fairly entrenched in the Donbass. But when you talk about kind of Russia's future as well, I think it's important, obviously, to note or to emphasize that it's not just Putin, yeah. That the people firing these missiles in Ukraine, the people torturing Ukrainians, the people torturing Russians who oppose the war in Ukraine, they're Russian citizens. They're just ordinary people. And there's a vast amounts of them who have been kind of sucked into this sadistic, security services, this sadistic military. And so that's what makes me most kind of, depressed about the future of Russia, because even if by some miracle Putin is toppled, what do you do with these people? What do you do with these hundreds of thousands, these millions of people who kind of seem to revel in, or seem to enjoy inflicting pain on others? And kind of Putin gave them this outlet for their sickest kind of fantasies in Ukraine. And I don't think this is the basis for building a kind of democratic, fair, society.
Well, Mark, you've given us, a depressing but very important, I think, perspective on Russia in this book and in this conversation. I'm very glad you agreed to join us today on Shield of the Republic. And I hope you get to go back to Russia. You indicate that you want to go back at some point. I hope the circumstances will be created to allow you and your wife and your daughter to go back at some point in a very different kind of Russia than the one you describe.
Amen to that. Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Uh-huh.